welcome to Talking History and the second show in our four-part series on the myths of the gunfighter in the American West. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. In a moment, we'll be speaking to Marley Brandt about Jesse James, perhaps the most famous gunfighter of all, and hearing from another historian, Claire McKenna, on the actual extent of gunfighting in the West. Was it as common as the Westerns of popular culture would suggest? We shall see. But before we do that, let's look back at this week in history. Next Monday, January 18th, the nation celebrates Martin Luther King Jr. Day. He was actually born, however, on January 15th, 1929, in Atlanta, Georgia. King, an eloquent black Baptist minister, led the American Civil Rights Movement from the mid-1950s until his death by assassination in 1968. He's best remembered for his I Have a Dream speech, delivered in front of the Lincoln Memorial during the 1963 March on Washington. But a major part of his legacy was the nonviolent approach he took in the Civil Rights Movement, in recognition of which, in 1964, he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, American researchers have discovered new evidence long buried in British military archives that famed U.S. aviator Amelia Earhart died on Kikamoro Island in the Polynesian Republic of Kiribati. Earhart's fate has been the subject of much speculation since she disappeared on July 2, 1937, while piloting a plane across the Pacific in an effort to become the first woman to fly around the world. British soldiers found bones on the island in 1940. Suspecting the bones were Earhart's, they sent them to a physician who concluded that they were the bones of a male. The International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, that has been searching for evidence of Earhart's demise for 10 years, recently discovered the long-lost report, and upon re-examining it, found that the doctor may have been wrong. The bones may have belonged to a woman who fits the aviator's physical description. Unfortunately, the bones themselves are nowhere to be found, so the search continues. You're listening to Talking History.
Jesse James! Jesse James! He was cursed with a great and reckless gun. Jesse James, and he played a game that no man ever won. Jesse James! But his villainy.
Last week, in the first show in our series on the myth of the gunfighter, we talked about the origins of America's obsession with outlaws of the Old West and the violent lives that they led. This week, we're going to take a look at one gunfighter in particular, Jesse James. So many legends have been spun around the life of Jesse James that we can hardly separate myth from reality without the help of an expert. Fortunately, we have such an expert with us today. Marley Brand is the author of Jesse James, The Man and the Myth, published this year by Berkeley Books. Reviewers have praised the author's insight not only into the life of Jesse James, but also into the period in which he lived, presenting the facts while dispelling the fiction, which is exactly what we want to do today. Welcome, Marley, and thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Marley, just how exaggerated is the myth or legend of Jesse James?
That's very complicated. While a lot of the myth of Jesse James has some basis in reality, the character of Jesse James has been subject to the whim of Hollywood. In the 30s, it was a dashing almost hero who put everything on the line for mom, apple pie, and the farm. In the 50s, he was the rebel with somewhat of a cause. By the 70s, he was a loony. And in the 80s and 90s, there have been attempts to examine the causes of his rebellion. The legends portray Jesse as daring, and he was that. The myth is that he was antisocial and surly. Nothing could be further from the truth. Myth and legend have him as a cold-blooded killer. Not really. That was more his brother Frank. The closest the myths and the legends have come to describing the real Jesse is that he was a larger-than-life figure in his own time.
Well, we'll want to touch on each of those. Did the myth precede the coming of film and television?
Well, yes, mostly because of Jesse. He had a driving desire to be noticed. And that could have been because of his position in his family or the abandonment by his father or whatever other psychological issues he may have had. But he was very interested in promoting himself. He loved the attention that the robbers of the Liberty Bank, Missouri Bank received. And he realized that by denying that he had been involved, which he may or may not have been, he could draw attention to himself on a statewide, maybe even a national level. So he enlisted the help of his friend John Newman Edwards, who was a former Confederate officer who was, at that time, the editor of the Kansas City Star. And together, they put together a publicity campaign that constantly had Jesse's name in front of the public. He would write letters to the editor denouncing his enemies and denying involvement in the robberies. And Edwards wrote editorials along those same lines. And through that, the public became familiar with Jesse, and his legend began to grow.
When approximately would Edwards have started this series?
That would be in the late 1860s.
So fairly early on in Jesse's career.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it almost started immediately with the first robbery.
And what was the image initially when he first started to make the press? What was the myth created so soon?
Well, it was after the Civil War, and so there was a lot of attention that was thrown on the, especially in Missouri, on the guerrilla fighters, of which Jesse was one. And there was this whole, the South was not ready to be defeated by many of the people there. The war, they couldn't put the war behind them. So this was a popular way for them to express their views through the press, with Edwards being the spearhead of that movement.
Okay. Did, unlike other heroes, or perhaps like other heroes, they made it into actually these dime novels, what we refer to in the late 19th century. Did James make it into any of that kind of literature?
Oh, absolutely. Soon after he began to be popular in the Missouri press, he was the subject of quite a few overblown stories of daring adventures in the dime novels.
And those were written largely back east.
Yes, they were.
Okay.
The newspaper outside his regional influence joined the ranks of those who examined the robberies that were being committed in the Midwest. Soon the legend, the local curiosity, was a national legend.
Interesting. Okay, let me take you back to a point you made earlier. I want to get back earlier in Jesse James' life. What was the impact of the Civil War on James turning to crime?
Well, his family came from the South, and his father's estate had more than a dozen slaves. And even though the slaves were considered a part of the family, it wasn't difficult for his mother to pick a side. And what motivated Jesse and Frank and their mother more than the slavery issue was the fact that they didn't like being told what to do or to have their minds up made for them. And Frank James was able to join the Confederate sympathizers in Missouri, but Jesse couldn't because he was too young. He was told to stay and help out on his family's farm. And after Frank joined with Quantrill's guerrilla soldiers, the Union soldiers were a common sight of the James family. They let horses loose, they burned fields, they beat Jesse and his mother, his pregnant mother, and eventually hung his stepfather until he was brain damaged. All this in an attempt to get the family to reveal Quantrill's whereabouts. So by the time Jesse was old enough to join Quantrill, he'd had enough. He was only 15 years old, but he made a vindictive, vengeful, and ruthless recruit. And the war would remain an issue with him for the rest of his life.
So it's an act of vengeance on his part. Or
yes, that's how it started. That's how it started.
And why would he turn to crime necessarily, or bank robbing, as a way of getting revenge?
Well, he would never forget or forgive the way he and his family were treated during the war. And after he started to recuperate from, he was shot while attempting to surrender, and he nearly died. And he went back to the farm to recuperate and attempt to repair their life. But because he and his brother had been with Quantrill, it was determined by the powers that be that they were to be arrested and hung. So they were outlaws, whether or not they chose to be, from that point on. They weren't allowed to take jobs, and they weren't allowed to move freely in their community or put the war behind them. So they decided, since they had no money and they had a powerful need for revenge, they turned to robbing the banks of the Union establishment.
So this is kind of the pop psychology of the romanticized James at this point, the taking vengeance on what happened to him and his family during the war.
Yes, except it had nothing to do with the railroad going through their farm.
Right. Understand. Okay. In your book, you talk about James as a career rebel. I think you've suggested a bit of that already, but maybe you could expand on that a little bit.
Well, although he said he tried to live a normal life, he became addicted to demonstrating his rebellion against the Yankee establishment. He had a need for revenge that always dictated his lifestyle.
And is this related all to your referring to him as a political activist? I mean, how do those two relate?
Well, Jesse, Frank, and the younger brothers came to represent the need for rebellion felt by the pro-Confederate veterans and people of Missouri. And their actions against a smothering, unfair Union Reconstruction represented the so-called losers of the war. And although those people weren't out robbing banks and trains, even though some of them would later, they supported the James Younger Gang by offering them shelter and food and alibi. And you know, the gang had many supporters. That's why Jesse was never caught.
Did he at all fit the image that sometimes we still see in stories of James about being a 19th century Robin Hood?
Sometimes he would. That really wasn't his main motivation. He was very generous to his family and to his friends. There weren't very many. A lot of the folklore says that, you know, he gave to widows and orphans and all of that. And he may have done that. but that wasn't really his motivation for robbing.
Maybe we should drop back here. How does he differ, you suggested earlier a bit of this, from his brother Frank and from the Youngers? I know you also wrote about the Youngers in one of your earlier books. Could you differentiate them in some way?
They were actually quite different, and a lot of the myth and legend of Jesse James was in reality Frank James. Frank quoted Shakespeare and had a level head. Jesse was impulsive and intense. But a lot of the cold-blooded killer image that Jesse has was really Frank James. That's the way that Frank James was. Jesse was very gregarious. He really liked people, and he had a need to have people like him, which doesn't always come out. He quoted the Bible, and he felt that a lot of his actions were sanctioned by God, as most sociopaths do.
Right.
But Jesse was fun-loving and had a quick wit. Frank was more the serious brooding type that really had the need for revenge that had nothing to do with elevating his status. A lot of the revenge that he would get involved with, he didn't have the need for people to know that it was him. He would just go out and kill somebody. Jesse wasn't like that.
Interesting. How about the Youngers?
The Youngers were more along Jesse's line, too, although Cole Younger in particular was, again, someone that liked to be recognized and known. And he was, of course, the first Younger that became involved in all of this, and he was that way. He had a lot of friends, and he felt very righteous about his revenge, too. And then the younger brothers of Cole were just kind of in it for the adventure.
If you could pick an event in James's life, his adult life, that you feel was the most dramatic and perhaps at the same time the most interesting in terms of how it was interpreted for the public as part of the myth, what would that be?
Oh, my goodness.
I know there were many, but could you pick one in particular?
Well, the events would all go back to the war. I mean, you know, the hanging of his stepfather as a youth was really something that shadowed a lot of his actions, because he just felt that was so unfair, and he lost it. His stepfather was a doctor, and he was hung until he was brain damaged, and he just felt that was so unfair. So a lot of the events that came out of that, I mean, there was the Northfield robbery, of course, which was late in his career with the James Younger gang, and it was very unpopular within the gang because he was coercing young Bob Younger to go to Minnesota, and the rest of the gang didn't really want to go, and of course the consequences were awful, and the Youngers were in prison for the rest of their life, and I think that was very dramatic for him. That kind of changed him into being very paranoid. You know, he could felt he could never trust anybody again, because he had been with them for most of his outlaw career, and when he had to get new recruits, he couldn't trust them, and he started doing impulsive acts at that point, which really changed, you know, it resulted in his assassination.
Yeah, Northfield is certainly one of those incidents that makes it into all of the James films at one point or another.
Yeah.
So. What about his assassination? There's so much myth surrounding that. I remember even as a young man reading various, you know, pop novels, and they all had different versions of the assassination. Give us the facts first. What actually happened?
Well, at that point in his life, he felt that, I believe that Jesse allowed himself to be killed because he was tired of the outlaw life, and he saw no other way out. He was warned that the people that he was associating with couldn't be trusted. Even his own mother believed that. Yet he was with them, and he had them into his own home. He was desperate at that time, really, to find someone that he felt that he could associate with. His friends were, a lot of his friends were gone, or, you know, they didn't want to be associated with him anymore. And he picked these two young men and brought them into his home and wanted to plan this one last robbery. That was what he said. He wanted to get the money to retire. And that's what he was doing at the time that they were in his home. And they had, in the meantime, had been hired by the Missouri governor to assassinate him.
Now, the two young men, there were Bob and Charlie Ford.
Bob and Charlie Ford.
And how did they go about killing him?
They just waited for an opportunity, which presented himself. Jesse allowed it to be presented. He turned his back on him. He took his guns off, and, you know, there it was. That's why I believe that it was suicidal.
True that he was standing on a chair hanging up a picture or something along
that
line?
He was dusting a picture, yes.
I see. Okay.
But there was no reason for him to put himself in that position. It was completely against his character.
You're suggesting here almost
his unarmed back anywhere on anybody, especially people that he didn't know that well.
But you're suggesting here almost that he had a death wish here, that he wanted to be killed.
I mean, I believe that he did. I believe that he just was tired of the whole thing, and he knew that there was no way out for him.
Was there no way he could get out? I mean, at this point,
he could have gone to prison, but that he was just such an independent spirit that would have killed him, too. Hmm. He didn't feel that he could get a fair trial, which maybe he could, maybe he couldn't. We don't know, but he just didn't feel any way out, and he felt that maybe this would be the best for his family, so that they wouldn't have to endure the embarrassment of a trial, you know, of which he would probably be convicted.
Interesting. Well, Bob Ford was the actual assassin. What happened to him after the assassination?
Well, there is speculation that did they ever really receive the money from Governor Crittenden of Missouri, and they probably did receive some, but a lot of people shared in the spoils of that. And he eventually went out to Creedy, Colorado, and opened up a saloon after trying to go on stage and tell his story of, I killed Jesse James. It wasn't well received. And he opened up a saloon out there, and he was killed out there by another fellow that had nothing to do with Jesse.
The other fellow wasn't looking for revenge
or
a reputation?
No, Bob Ford was not a popular person. He was into self-aggrandizement, and, you know, he just decided to try to do everything he could to draw attention to himself, which was kind of carrying on the Jesse's tradition.
Why don't you think Bob Ford, wouldn't he become a hero for killing the notorious outlaw?
It wasn't popular to kill the notorious outlaw. Jesse was very, very popular. Even though people said, well, you know, he robbed banks and trains, and they were glad that it wasn't them, he still represented the everyman, a lot of it. And he may have been popular. I'm sure he was popular with some people, you know, the Yankee establishment. But for a lot of the people, it was not favorable that he was shot in the back. I mean, that's not the way to do it. If it had been a showdown or something, it might have been completely different. But Bob Ford shot him in the back, and you know, no one liked that, particularly at that time.
Right. Well, still down. I suppose that's the ultimate slur, that they
put
behind his back, stabbed him in the back,
or whatever. That's why he was called the dirty little coward.
Right, right. What about Frank? What happened to him later?
Well, after Jesse was killed, a few months after Jesse was killed, got together with John Newman Edwards, and they decided that he would surrender, which he did to the governor. And he had three trials. They said, "Look, if you're gonna, you know, if you're gonna charge him, let's get it all done with." So he was charged on three counts of murder and robbery, and he was acquitted. He was acquitted on all counts. And then after that, he took a variety of menial jobs and lived out the rest of his life in peace. He died at the age of 72.
Well, let me take you back then. If Frank got off, why wouldn't Jesse have had the same situation?
Well, they felt that a lot of Frank's acquittal was due to the sympathy for the murder of Jesse.
Okay, I understand. Well, the ultimate question we ask this about all these gunfighter heroes, why do you think the American public chose to make a legend of Jesse James? What about him in particular, and we only have a minute here, made him a hero in the American mind?
Well, I think that most Americans, by virtue of our nationality, have a rebellious nature. And Jesse was the James Dean, the Madonna of his time. He represented freedom and the right to be heard. He's continued to be popular because he was portrayed in film by dashing leading men with guns a-blazing. I get maybe 10 calls a day from people who want me to confirm that they were either related to him directly or to one of his gang members. I think in a time when many people feel a victim of the government or of the power elite, identifying with Jesse James is comforting to them. I think he'll always be popular. I think his life will always be questioned and studied, and he'll always continue to be one of America's foremost legends, probably forever.
Interesting stuff. The rebel, freedom, right to be heard, I suppose rugged individualism in the extreme.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah.
Right. Well, we're out of time, unfortunately, but thank you very much for being with us. That was fascinating.
You.
Great. Hope to have you again.
Thank you.
Okay. You're listening to Marley Brandt, the author of Jesse James, The Man and the Myth, published this year by Berkeley Books. Welcome back to Talking History. For our historic site of the week, following up on our discussion of one of America's most notorious gunfighters, Jesse James, we have picked James St. Joseph, Missouri home. Here to describe what you will see there is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
If you're on the trail of Jesse James, St. Joseph, Missouri is the place for you.
first stop on the must-see places is the Jesse James House Museum. Furnished as it looked when the James family lived there. And then there is the Jesse James home, where he was shot and killed, complete with the bullet hole in the wall from the April 1882 shooting. There is also the Buchanan County Courthouse, where the Ford brothers were tried for the murder of Jesse James. And don't miss the Missouri Valley Trust Building, where overland freighters, Confederate and Union soldiers, fur traders, and Pony Express riders all did business in the bank. Local legend has it that Jesse James cased the bank shortly before he was gunned down. There is also the Pony Express Museum and many other rich exhibits of the Old West in St. Joseph. And if you feel like you want to take a bit of the Old West home with you, stop at the Stetson Hat Factory Outlet on your way out of town.
In movies and on television, gunfights in the Old West happened every day, sometimes more than once a day. But just how common were gunfights? What does the historical record show? In this week's op-ed, historian Claire McKenna talks about what he has discovered concerning the reality of gunplay in the Old West. McKenna, professor of history at San Diego State University, is the author of Homicide, Race, and Justice in the American West, published by the University of Arizona Press in 1997. He has titled his op-ed for today, The Myth of the Gunfighter.
The tradition of the gunfight portrayed in such Western films as High Noon and Chain still holds power over the imagination of many Americans. However, the Western gunfight is a myth. In the American West, you were more likely to be killed in the saloon than in a traditional gunfight. In the past, historians of the American West had portrayed violence as essentially episodic, involving gunfights in cattle towns and range wars between cattlemen and sheepmen. However, their sources in the traditional narrative style of history have left these authors unaware of the obvious. A common form of lethal violence occurred daily in the American West, homicide, committed by ranchers, farmers, cowboys, coal and copper miners, bartenders, cooks, gamblers, pimps, police officers, sheriff's deputies, rushers, drunks, and yes, occasionally even a housewife. Homicide was commonplace in the West. However, gunfights were rare. In my recent book, Homicide, Race, and Justice in the American West, 1880 to 1920, and in my current research discussing lethal violence in seven California and four Kansas counties, I have examined 2,704 homicide cases. A violent confrontation could occur in virtually any saloon, and statistics confirm that they often did. On numerous occasions, individuals argued over too much foam on the beer, drinks on credit, 50-cent bets, and other minor issues. Vendettas, racial animosities, love triangles, domestic disputes, strikes, and police shootings provide other scenarios for killings. Alcohol figured prominently in homicide scenarios. For example, killers and victims drank prior to committing homicide in about 65% of the cases. However, it is the pervasive nature of gun culture that best illustrates high levels of lethal violence in the American West. The existence of a strong gun culture increased the likelihood that disputes might turn lethal. It was an invitation to violence. Killers ranging in age from 14 to 69 carried cheap handguns, patterned on the Webley British Bulldog double-action revolver patented in 1883. Most weighed about 16 ounces and had about 2.5 to 3-inch barrels that could easily be concealed in coat or pants pockets. Harrington Richardson, Ivor Johnson, and other American arms manufacturers copied this design and produced thousands of these five-shot revolvers in .38 and .32 calibers. The consequences are reflected in a handgun homicide rate that averaged 63%. And in a combined gun homicide rate of about 75%. Out of 2,704 homicide cases, only around one dozen killings fit within the category of what you might call gun fights. Why, then, has this myth of the gun fights revived? Well, two factors seem to illuminate this. Novels and films, both depicting the American West, have ingrained the gunfighter into the American subconscious. Whether it is McMurtry's Lonesome Dove, or Clint Eastwood's film, Unforgiven, both fiction, incidentally, the image of the gunfighter or hired killer looms very large. Nevertheless, it was and is a myth.
You've been listening to Claire McKenna, professor of history at San Diego State University and the author of Homicide, Race, and Justice in the American West, published by the University of Arizona Press. finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, where we call to your attention upcoming films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else that may be of interest to you. The second annual Celebrate History Conference has been scheduled for April 9 through 11 at the South San Francisco Conference Center. Planners of this year's conference, titled All Eras, All Interests, All Together, promise something for just about every history lover. Books, collectibles, living history reenactments, board and computer games, and much more. There may even be a Sweethearts Through History Ball. But to find out more about that, email the organizers at info@celebratehistory.com. And if you're a runner who also likes history, you might sign up for the Vicksburg Run Through History 10K Road Race, which will be held on March 6th. The race starts in the historic Vicksburg, Mississippi National Military Park, which commemorates the Civil War Battle of Vicksburg and traces a route past cannon, reconstructed fortifications and trenches, markers and monuments. For more information on this exercise in history, access the homepage at runthroughhistory.org. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for the third in our special four-part series on gunfighters of the Old West, when we will talk about Wyatt Earp. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. Thank you.